Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. There is more discussion about St. Louis City County reunification. We'll join that discussion a little bit later. But first, Public Radio's WBEZ in Chicago, working with the Center for Investigative Reporting and the weekly Chicago Reader newspaper, has spent a year investigating how heroin makes its way from Mexico through the Midwest to Chicago. St. Louis is on the route. The resulting report will be aired on this station as part of the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Public Radio Exchange's Reveal series tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. The heroin traffic story takes on new relevance with the arrest a few days ago of Mexican drug figure Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Joining me by phone from Chicago to talk about the report is WBEZ reporter Natalie Moore, who worked on the Reveal story. With me in studio is Dan Duncan, Associate Executive Director of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area. Also in studio is Sergeant Mark Whitson. He is with the St. Louis County Police DEA Collaborative Drug Task Force. I thank you all so much for being with us.
Morning,
Dan. Nice to see you. Natalie, thank you for joining us.
Sure, glad to be here.
I'll begin with you if I can. Obviously, we have to kind of do the Cliff Notes version, but give us the essence of the Reveal report.
Well, we did a series here at WBEZ with the Reader that aired and ran last December that looked at the heroin pathways, the business part of it. We didn't focus as much on the addiction aspect, although, of course, that is absolutely a part of it. But we wanted to look at this is big business, and our series was called Heroin LLC. And you mentioned El Chapo Guzman. He is public enemy number one in Chicago, and the last person to have that title was Al Capone. And we wanted to look at the pathways from Mexico to Chicago, Chicago neighborhoods to the suburbs, and then how that heroin goes out to the rest of the Midwest, including places like St. Louis.
There's an awful lot of it comes through the Midwest, isn't there?
Yeah, so El Chapo Guzman has said that, you know, he wants to set up in Chicago. And his operation with the Sinaloa cartel is not unlike any other Fortune 500 business coming to Chicago in the middle of the country. Good transportation, railroads, trucking. And it's easy for the heroin and other drugs to fan out to the other parts.
This is a fair.
And there's also a large Latino community, Mexican American community in Chicago. So you have some, logistics people, as they are called, who are blending into Chicago neighborhoods.
You know, I listened to the report, and I was really stunned to learn that there are more people in the drug trafficking trade in Chicago than there are utility employees in that city.
Right, on the west side of Chicago. Now, the most visible face of the drug trade, like it would be in any other major market, would be young black and brown men who are low-level drug dealers. You know, they are just at the bottom of the supply chain. But the west side of Chicago is a mostly impoverished community, lots of high foreclosures, unemployment. Industry has left. So manufacturing jobs that have exited that community, and even Sears Roebuck used to be on the west side, you have people who are in the underground economy, in the drug trade, and that would be the west side of Chicago's story in all of this.
What is the basic pathway from Juarez to Chicago?
You have... some people may question, well, why isn't there better security at the border? How do drugs get in? But the sheer volume, I think, is something that's prohibitive from, everything being checked. We have millions of cars and people, vehicles who are crossing that Juarez border to get into the United States. So those drugs come up to Chicago. They go into, maybe big warehouse, I would say wholesale suppliers up in Chicago, and then there's some that go to warehouses. And one of the stories that I did looked at where there had been big heroin busts in the region, and they tended to be on the southwest side of Chicago and the southwest suburbs. And these stash houses are not where people are going to knock on the door and buy drugs. These are, bungalows on quiet streets that are warehousing tens of millions of dollars and tens of millions of dollars worth of drugs. And then they go out to mid-level and low-level dealers. And then the relationship that we see in this region is that there's a lot of back and forth. So I mentioned the west side of Chicago being an open-air drug market, and the proximity to the western suburbs. 290 Expressway is known as Heroin Highway. So you have people going back and forth. You have people delivering to the suburbs. You have people buying from the suburbs. You have people distributing from the suburbs and, you know, getting their drugs to and fro.
This stuff is pretty easy to transport. Is it not very compact and easy to hide?
Absolutely. It's not as bulky as heroin. It's more compact than cocaine. And, you know, there drugs go in and out of popularity. So heroin is a lot cheaper right now. It's more recreational, and you can snort it. You don't have to shoot it. And we had kids in story say that it's easier to get heroin than prescription drugs. Another reason why heroin is on the rise in usage is because, you know, it's an opiate, like what we find in prescription drugs. And, you know, while law enforcement and, you know, the industry has cracked down on the availability of prescription drugs, heroin can give you that same kind of high. And it's easier and much cheaper to get. 30 years ago, a bag of heroin would have run you $50. Today, you can get a bag between $5 and $10.
What did you learn, Natalie, in doing your reporting that you didn't know before? What really surprised you?
Lots of surprises. The availability for treatment. You know, if you have money, it's easier to get treatment than if you're poor. The relationship that people have to drugs. You know, drug dealers aren't just, you know, wholesalers. They aren't just people on the corner. A lot of times people sell drugs to support their habit. I was also surprised to see where the warehousing was and the fact that people in these neighborhoods weren't connecting these dots. El Chapo Guzman's name is now, you know, in the press more, and people have an awareness in Chicago because he was apprehended last month. But I think that there was just a lot that people didn't know, and I was a little surprised that people, for the most part, hadn't been connecting these dots and really weren't aware of the heroin epidemic that we have in the region.
Is his departure from the scene going to change anything?
That's the question that everyone is asking. I'm tending to think no, because we have to understand the demand side. The supply side is there because people want to use drugs. And, you know, there are questions about whether there should be decriminalization of drugs. You know, do we look at this as a public health issue? Right now, law enforcement is the primary player in all of this. And law enforcement can't stop people from wanting to use drugs. And we've had our own, you know, law enforcement, our police chief in Chicago has acknowledged that. So I tend to think that we aren't looking at the problem in a holistic way. We are just criminalizing it and letting law enforcement deal with it.
Well, you catch your breath for just a second, and we'll bring the other guests into the conversation. And Sergeant Whitson, I'll start with you. You can't stop people from the habit once they have it. Can you stop the drugs from coming through?
Well, you can try, but it's very hard. And she hit it right on the button. The cartel people, they don't produce this products. They are strictly logistics. And if you look at the current situation in Mexico, the fights over the logistics, the points of entry in the country originally in North Mexico, and now it's spread to other parts of Mexico because of the ports. There's intelligence out there that the Sinaloa cartel is trying to establish points, logistical points, and Chicago is one of the primary areas they're looking at because of their contacts up there in the Latin community and the Latin gangs that are up there. So she's very much on part, and the drugs is just part of it. They deal in a lot of other different things also. So when people talk about legalization of marijuana that's going to destroy the cartels, it's not. I mean, they're into bootlegging videos. They're into stealing oil from Pemex and bringing it across the border. And then also the situation to shut the border down. You can't do it. I mean, there's so much business across that border, over a million legal crossings every day. And those point of entries like Juarez, Nogales, those cities would just go under on both sides of the border if their business was taken away.
Well, a lot of it is going to Chicago, but a lot of it is stopping here. We have a fairly active drug traffic here, do we not? And I'm talking literally about traffic.
Yes, we do. And the thing about it is, as far as the transnational criminal organizations, as they refer to them, is for St. Louis, most of our stuff comes from Chicago. So what will happen is it'll just pass through St. Louis. Go to Chicago. There's certain areas in this country that the cartel people have established as their, like, headquarters. Chicago, Denver, Atlanta, New York City, go out to L.A. So a lot of times they go to those places and then disperse past from there and come back to St. Louis, for example. In Chicago, for us, Chicago is a very big. There's we have some criminal organizations that are transporting. We get our methamphetamine out of Mexico or coming from the Kansas City area a lot, or Denver area too. So all of our highways are very important because that's the principal way they transport, is the highways and the railroads.
And Dan Duncan, a lot of that stays right here.
Yeah, it's been a steady growth over the last 10 years, specifically almost 10 years, on both sides of the river throughout the region. And it's unfortunate that the willing marketplace that they have is primarily suburban youth.
And we've lost a lot of young people in recent years.
The number we have right now for all opioid deaths since we started tracking about 6.5 years ago is exactly 1,900 people, mostly young people. That means probably by the middle of the year we'll be up to 2,000. And it's a staggering number.
Why has heroin come back into vogue? I mean, a lot of us thought that this, was something from a generation and a half or two ago.
Well, Natalie hit on a couple of key points. Once the cartels, and they are functioning as businesses, once they figured out if they can offer a powdered form, cheaply, potent, then you have removed the needle from the equation, which was a barrier for a lot of people who would use this drug or that drug, but they wouldn't touch anything that required a needle injection. If they can snort it, they look at it, a lot of young people look at it as, similar to cocaine, or maybe they've used meth. So the fear factor is reduced. The price point certainly helped. The availability is an issue. All those things combined at a point in time where, in my opinion, we've become – I think we're suffering from the laxity of our approach toward drugs. We've softened up as a nation. We're talking more and more about things like marijuana is not that big of a deal. We should probably just legalize it. Not me, but a lot of other people.
We're coming pretty close in a lot of places.
We are, and we are. We're there in a couple of places. And I think that too, has contributed toward young people's regard toward all drugs. And it's kind of bled over into this attitude of I'm willing to try this, I'm willing to try that, without knowing, in the case of heroin or any opiate for that matter, just how dangerous they are, just how lethal these drugs are. The overdose drug count certainly speaks to that.
Well, that's Dan Duncan. Dan Duncan is the Associate Executive Director of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area. He is with me in studio, as is Sergeant Mark Whitson with the St. Louis County Police DEA Collaborative Drug Task Force. And joining us by phone from Chicago is Natalie Moore of WBEZ Radio in Chicago. She is part of a report that is going to be airing on this station tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock as part of the Reveal series. Let's take our break now, come back, and have more of this conversation. If you folks in the listening audience would like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. If you have concerns or experience with heroin addiction, we'd particularly like to hear from you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. And send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back with Natalie, Mark, and Dan in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation about the heroin traffic in and around and through St. Louis in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Organizers of the Taste of St. Louis Festival announced today that they're moving the event from downtown St. Louis to Chesterfield this fall. It's the second major event to announce in the last few weeks that it'll be leaving the city. The Blues Week Festival says its 2014 event will be held at the Chesterfield Amphitheater. amphitheater. It's the first day of early voting in Illinois. The primary election is March 18th. Election officials say they're not predicting a high turnout with wintry weather and cold temperatures hitting parts of the state. Four Republicans are seeking their party's nomination for governor. They are State Treasurer Dan Rutherford, businessman Bruce Rauner, and State Senators Kirk Dillard and Bill Brady. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stopublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Natalie Moore of WBEZ Radio in Chicago, Dan Duncan, Associate Director of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for this area, and Mark Whitson, Sergeant. He is with the St. Louis County Police DEA Collaborative Drug Task Force. Natalie, back to you. The figure we just heard from Dan Duncan of 1,900 deaths here is a stunning figure. What kind of numbers do you have up there in Chicago with regard to heroin deaths?
Well, I can first tell you about ER visits. Chicago area leads the nation in heroin-related ER, emergency room visits. So in 2011, we had close to 25,000. And the second closest city to us would be Boston, and that was under 15,000. So, you know, 10,000 more visits. Also, the number of heroin seizures in kilograms has doubled. Well, actually, nationwide has doubled since 2008. And then Chicago would be a leader in that also. I don't have any death stats right at my fingertips right now, but, you know, that we have had a lot of young people in the suburbs succumb to that also. The two biggest users would be older African Americans, and then the fastest growing group would be young white suburbanites.
How about on intercepting the drugs that are coming into the city? How well does Chicago and federal and local law enforcement in Chicago do at that?
Well, I can say, you know, one thing that raised my interest in even pursuing this back a few years when the head of the Chicago DEA office came from El Paso. So for me, it was like, okay, we have a border person coming to Chicago who has really referred to Chicago as a border city, even though we are nowhere near Mexico. So there have been a lot of resources put into this area to try to take down the Sinaloa cartel. And then there are a number of federal cases in the courts here in Chicago that are related to the Sinaloa cartel.
But there's no way, obviously, of telling exactly how much is getting through. Obviously, a lot of it is.
Right. And, you know, again, with the story that I did, you know, just looking at those seizures in those, you know, pockets of the region, you know, I don't think that doesn't tell the full picture, but, you know, there's presumably a lot that isn't getting seized.
Sure. Sergeant, let me turn to you. How well do we do here in the interception game?
We do okay, but we know that we're not getting enough. I'd say there has been reports as far as like money seizures or money going back to the border that we probably seize maybe 10% of the actual money that gets across the border. 10% of that we seize, the other 90% makes it across the border.
How much is the 10%?
Oh, God knows. It's billions, billions without a doubt. So to say that we're making a huge impact, no, but we are out there. I mean, there's officers working all the way from the border trying to intercept this stuff, and it's a gauntlet, to say the least, that they have to run to get it up there. But it's a numbers game too, and what they'll do is they just flood the country. And losing a load is part of doing business for them. It can be easily replaced. So there's literally lots of vehicles, lots of trains, they're body carrying it on buses, body carrying it on trains, shipping it. It'll come up the waterways too. So it's a very tough job with the limited resources.
Of course. And Dan Duncan, with this kind of money involved and the amount of product, if I can use that term, coming through, a little wonder that we have the kind of stats here that you've mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, the money makes the world go around, and it's what gets people in this business to begin with. And I think until such time that we kind of change course to a degree and start looking at something else that Natalie mentioned, which is the demand. This country has a thirst to get high. And until we really get serious about addressing the demand, I don't think much is going to change. We've got to look at in the heroin town halls that Mark and I have been involved with over the last 3 years, we've been saying to groups that we have to have more and better community education, primarily prevention for youth. That's a huge issue that's almost underserved, is served, treatment, and law enforcement. It's a four-legged stool. And we've been putting, I think, an unfair burden on law enforcement to deal with almost all this. I just don't think it's fair to them to say you have to take care of all this and clean up because they can't. It's too much.
Natalie, what kind of programs? Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to weigh in on that. You know, when the war on drugs was started, there was equal money to law enforcement and then prevention. And what we've seen is the tide just go to law enforcement, and the prevention side just really isn't there.
It's tough. There's no question about it. I have a number of calls. I'd like to get to as many of them as we can. And let's begin with Glenda calling from St. Louis. Glenda, go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenda.
Hi, I'm a 45-year-old mother of a 25-year-old son, and I pretty much had to raise my grandson to turn 6 in a few months. Which my son's been clean for about a year now, I guess, almost a year. But it has been the most horrific experience that I have ever gone through as a family, just with my child. I can't tell you how many times I've rushed to the emergency room because he's OD'd, you know. And they're right about it being too much for law enforcement. It is such an epidemic that really grassroots, getting to these kids and letting these kids know how toxic this stuff is. It's not just one high. Because even though the heroin is coming across in powder form, once the kids do it, like, you know, they start out stealing pills from their grandparents or whatever, and then it escalates. But once they've snorted this a couple of times, they always want that bigger high, and they do end up using it intravenously. And it's so addictive. My son has lost so many friends who have OD'd and died in another room while other people sat in the other room and continued to get high. It's more than just what the average police officer can do anything about.
Glenda, thank you. Go ahead, Glenda, if you want to finish up.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I want to thank you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome.
And best of luck to you and your son. I hope that straightens itself out. Dan Duncan, this is a story you've heard many times before.
That's the story. Yeah. Glenda tells the story that we hear every day. Yeah. The impact on families has been horrific. It's hard to put into words what I've seen and experienced the last few years. I think if almost anyone out there who was really aware of what we're seeing and hearing, Glenda's story, would support us in saying that we have to do more and we have to do better because it is an epidemic. When we see these number of young people dying, if you can imagine it would be some other cause for this illness, we'd be scrambling all over ourselves to do something. And it's not to say that we aren't doing anything. It's that overall we collectively as a city, as a state, as a culture are not doing enough.
All right. And Natalie, you've heard that story before as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also the comment on this is we cannot just look at heroin in a bubble. It's the prescription drug issues that's on the outside of that. Almost all of these young people have started on prescription drugs. And recent University of Michigan study, Monitoring the Future, which has studied the drug use of high schoolers since 1975, came out. And the prescription drugs are just now getting on their radar as far as what they study. The concern is they all know it's bad. Heroin's bad, but the prescription drugs, their perception is that it's not risky. So when you take that, lower that risk, once they get to the prescription drug, especially the painkillers, they're going to go to heroin. They're going to go to heroin. They're going to flip-flop back and forth just because of the price.
And once you're on heroin, you're really stuck.
The withdrawal symptoms. Most people tell you, I don't like to be a heroin, but the withdrawal symptoms from a heroin and prescription drug abuse – is horrendous, and that's what hurts them.
One additional point that I have to make any time this is brought up, and Mark's absolutely right. We've learned more and more about how prescription drugs have been the entree to heroin use. But almost every case, if you really go even further back, it starts in middle school with marijuana and alcohol. And it has to be stated that is the gateway to the rest of this. And those who think that it's not are kidding themselves, because that's how it starts.
And Natalie, Chicago's not immune to the same scenario.
No, it's not. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the prescription drugs have been a gateway, and not just for young people. But we did hear repeatedly that it was harder to get those prescription drugs. And again, I think a lot of us think of heroin as this end-of-the-line drug. And in the past, it was. You know, people have been abusing several other drugs before they got to that point. And I think a lot of us had that imagery of the needle and the down-and-out heroin addict. But again, it is. For some people, this is the first drug. It is seen as recreational for a lot of people.
Let's bring in Jenya, calling from St. Louis, who I think was caught in that at one point as well. Jenya, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment about what you were discussing, why heroin had come back in vogue. And I guess I'm part of what you would call the white suburbanite youth that is all of a sudden having this problem, because I'm 19 and I'm from an affluent area and I am a recovering heroin addict. And the reason I think people like me, it's spreading to people like me, is the combination of the fact that, yes, it is more available to just down the street now, as opposed to, you know, some mysterious area no one knows about, but also it's an emotional base. Like, why is the youth so discontent that they are seeking out prescription drugs and things like heroin that numb them to the things that we, like, the emotional problems are what needs to be dealt with for things like this to stop, is what I'm trying to say.
Jenya, thanks so much for the call. That, Dan, it's a key question. What is bothering the kids today that they have to turn to this?
Well, you know, that's a bigger question than I think any of us can answer. But she is correct in that when we look at the emotional issues of youth in terms of primarily anxiety and depression, these are the kids oftentimes that are going to look for something outside of themselves, that are going to experiment with chemicals and become addicted because it, to some degree, it's self-medicating. It fills a hole in their soul. So here again, you know, the mental health issues of our youth have to be addressed better, earlier. In St. Louis County, thankfully, we did pass the St. Louis County Children's Tax Fund a few years ago, and we are seeing that money now starting to flow out to agencies who are dealing with these issues. So we are building a better infrastructure locally, but I take her point. This affected youth, it's always been there. It's to what degree, you know? Yeah. And I do think it's grown. And it's a huge social issue that I don't know that I have the answer for, Don.
It seems to be growing rather than getting – and despite the resources that are going into it. Well, what sort of anti-drug programs do you have up there in Chicago, Natalie? Effective?
I would like to respond to, you know, what the caller brought up as well. You know, there are a number of parents in affluent suburbs who don't believe that this could be happening in their community. There are young people who aren't necessarily disaffected for experimenting. You could have students who are, you know, top high school students who are looking at college, prepping for the ACT and the SAT, but they might also be using heroin. One researcher who I've interviewed and a lot of us in the series talk to is with the Illinois Consortium on Drug Policy at Roosevelt University. And she gets a lot of calls from parents who say, how should I talk to my kids about drugs? And one thing that she said is that parents and people in society, we're not really honest about drugs. Does your child have anxiety about school? You know, really kind of understanding what is going on in that child's life. And it's not just kids who are runaways or some of these stereotypes that we might have in our head about who would be likely to use drugs. In Naperville, and we get into this in the reveal excerpt, there were some students who did a documentary about drug use, and it completely rocked that suburb because people have been turning a blind eye and just didn't think it could happen in a community like theirs.
And Naperville is an affluent community, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Now let's take another call, and this one will be Jim calling from Kirkwood. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
Yeah, one thing I was glad to hear you guys talk about prescription drugs. I had a daughter who was addicted to Xanax and Valium, who had a prescription for 120 Valium a month. And one of the biggest problems I see is they spend too much money on law enforcement and not enough availability for rehab. If you don't have a lot of money or really good insurance, there's nothing for you out there. Absolutely no help whatsoever for an addicted teen. And my other comment is it a coincidence that since we've been in Afghanistan, we've had a heroin addiction? Or is that just, or am I wrong to think that that's where it's coming from?
Let's ask the sergeant.
That's false. All of our heroin in this country comes from South America or Mexico. A very small piece comes from Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan produces 63% of the world's heroin, but the infrastructure for them is built into Europe, and all of their heroin goes to the European market. It's Mexico and South America that we obtain ours. Small amounts, I'm not going to say they're small amounts. I've heard some come from West Africa, from Nigeria and stuff like that, but we can't blame the Taliban for that, you know.
Well, we also have to point out that ours is not the only country that has an addiction problem.
Exactly.
Clearly.
It's a world problem. It's a world problem. I mean, I've recently read studies in India and obviously in Pakistan itself. They have their own issues with heroin. And it's kind of false that we can't blame the war or our problem or our situation in Afghanistan now on our drug problem here. This was something that it's this hemisphere that is the problem.
I have an email here from Ken who says, one of your guests stated the drugs are moving via rail. Can he please elaborate? Freight versus Amtrak, drugs or proceeds?
Both. Both. They're rail. They will – a kilo of heroin's $35,000, $40,000 worth of heroin. It's 2.2 pounds. You can put it in a backpack, and they will put people on buses and on trains to carry it. You can hide it in railroad cars. We recently involved an operation. Actually, this was a marijuana case. My group's attached to Homeland Security, so we work with Customs and Border Protection and the Border Patrol. And it was 23,000 pounds of marijuana in railroad cars going from El Paso Juarez Crossing to Chicago. And so they use both.
You're right in the middle of this. On a scale of 1 to 10, where would you say we are in the area of interception?
Well, we're a cross-through place. We are big. I mean, my group, not trying to brag, but my group does a lot of seizures. We're one of the bigger seizures in Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security in the country. But our group also includes Effingham. So you go up I-57, there's a lot of – if you're running your products out of East Texas – chances are they're going to go I-10, cut over and come up through Memphis through I-55 and then cut over and maybe come up through I-57. So Effingham does a lot of work with our group, and we work with Rolla PD quite a bit too.
Anything to add to that, Natalie?
No, I would just agree with all that, yeah.
Let me take another call as time begins to get away from us. Mike is calling from Webster Groves. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Don. It seems to me that we've been fighting the war on drugs for, I guess, about 40 years, and it doesn't seem to have worked. And alcoholism is a problem in our culture, but it seems to me that the best way to deal with it is through groups like Alcohol Anonymous, where they actually deal with the issues that they're having for the addiction. What we really need is information. And what the war on drugs is really a perversion of our own freedom to decide how we want to behave. And kids know this. And they, if we don't tell them in a free environment how to behave and how drugs can kill you, they'll learn on their own, and they'll get their drugs from criminals.
Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have a lousy connection. We can barely hear you. I think we have the gist of it. Let's get some response. The parental role in this, and Dan, let me turn to you for that.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time I said this, but parents can do everything right. and still develop this problem within their own household. We see lots of great parents out there who are doing a good job, whose kids are still experimenting. I think in a way Mike was making the point that I tried to make earlier, that we've got to get serious about community education, about prevention, you know, and we've learned a lot of lessons about what to do and what not to do.
Yeah. I want to take a call from Jane, who's joining us from Wildwood. Jane, thank you for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I lost my son in August to a heroin overdose. And since then, I've been putting my efforts towards trying to find the hand that gave it to my son. And I think that's pretty – I've been told that I'm finding out that it's pretty futile. And I just wondered what direction I should put my efforts to try and change what's going on. I think where I'm leaning is parental awareness on the signs to look for in your children and the education that the parents need to have. I don't really know where to turn or what to do.
Jane, we are so sorry for your loss, and hopefully we can give you some help at this table. Dan Duncan, I'll start with you and work around the entire room.
Well, I think a grief support group is very helpful for a while for somebody who's in her unfortunate situation. And when she feels like she's ready, if it's an hour later, to get involved with an organization like ours, we're utilizing parents who have learned the hard way what's going on to help educate other parents. So there are avenues and there are things that you can do to you know, be part of the solution.
Jane, we'll have a link to the website for the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. You can find that at stlpublicradio.org. Sergeant, what do you think?
This is kind of a personal thing to me, too. My girlfriend lost her son 4 years ago. He's 18 years old. And she struggled with the same thing that's going on here, trying to find out who supplied the drugs, that kind of thing. And it can be futile and it can be self-destructive for the person themselves. It's a long process they have to go through to come back, you know. But there are groups out there. There are parents groups, support groups of the people that have lost heroin. Heroin Anonymous has groups that meet, and they also have parental groups too. And I think Bridgeway in St. Charles was had a group
right
together through Bridgeway, and I can't remember the exact name of the group though. Damn, I.
If she or anybody else wants to get that information, they can call us at 962-3456. Ask for a counselor. We can give you that information.
Yeah, and I'm gonna give a shout out to NCADA for our police department. When I talk to people that's in the situation, that's the one place I send them. NCADA.
We'll put all of this information on our website again at stlpublicradio.org. Natalie, of course, what you're doing, this project you've been involved in for so long now, is also part of this education process, and that's certainly why you're doing it, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're so involved in this as reporters, we think that people know so much of this, and they really didn't. So, you know, as our job as journalists, what we see our mission as is, you know, putting the information out there and letting people know what is happening and that it's happening all over. It's not just one socioeconomic group. It's not just one race. This is impacting so many types of communities.
Yeah. We have limited time. I do want to take one more call, though. But, Jerry, I'm going to ask you to make a very quick question or comment, please, because time's getting away.
Thank you. Yes. Two things. You know, you talked about kids trusting the information they get, and with the debate over legalization or quasi-legalization of marijuana, there's so much misinformation by government people, essentially in the, you know, drug enforcement industry. And so I don't doubt that they feel they've been misinformed. And I think the other point is, if you want to use something like marijuana, then it is the gateway to criminal activity. And I think that's a key point that no one talks about. And I think the legalization would probably go a long way towards, you know, just as if you'd have to go see a bootlegger to buy a bottle of scotch, in the, you know, back in the during Prohibition. So I think legalization would probably help people, you know, would take them out of that chain, because someone who sells drugs is interested in moving you to the next step. That's how they make their money.
Jerry, thanks so much for the call. I think you're going to find some disagreement here. Dan, I'll start with you, then Mark, and then Natalie.
It's a simplistic answer to a complicated issue. I would disagree strongly. I do agree that we probably – and we really are on the path of decriminalizing a lot. We have been for years. That's about as far as I can go, I think, to legalize would be a huge mistake.
Sergeant?
I'm in a tough position here. We decriminalized. I came on the department in 1979. It was decriminalized early in the 80s. Here's my thing. There's a lot of studies out there, especially with adolescents. Eight times – if you start chronic use of marijuana at a younger age, eight times more onset of schizophrenia. And, you know, we're dealing with the issues of mental illness right now with our active shooters and school shooters where they're talking about – and now we're looking at legalizing a drug that could potentially exacerbate that conditions. Now, here's my opinion is there's no long-term studies. Very few long-term studies of where this is going to be. And really, Colorado's a guinea pig right now. And we'll have to see what that is. Right now, the big thing is money, money, money. We're making a lot of money. But, you know, it's kind of funny, the same people that are against big business are really kind of pro-marijuana, and that's a big business right now.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm surely not going to have a dog in this fight, but, you know, that's right. Just my opinion. I think we could really slow roll this and take our time with this before we go to where we're going to do.
And Natalie, a final word from you on this.
Yeah, I think the subtext of all of this is the war on drugs and what is it doing. Northwestern University just a couple of weeks ago did a big symposium called Rethinking the War on Drugs. I mentioned that, you know, drugs impact all communities, all races, but we have seen a racialization when it comes to sentencing and who goes to prison. And so I think that those are the first conversations that need to be had in thinking about who you're locking up. Does it make sense to lock up people who are drug users? Does it make sense to lock up people who had small amounts? Again, the face that we see of drugs and the one that people automatically think of are young black and brown faces. And the story is much bigger than that, but that's who's being sent to prison.
Well, that story is going to be on our air tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Natalie Moore's reporting can be heard in the Reveal Heroin Report, airing again on this station, St. Louis Public Radio, tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Natalie Moore of WBEZ Radio, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We look forward to listening to that. Dan Duncan, thank you for being with us as well. Good to see you again. And Sergeant Mark Whitson, thank you also for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Dan.
We'll take a break now and come back with Jason Rosenbaum. We'll talk a little bit about the latest discussion on city-county reunification. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.